It's time for A La Moog with Seamus Maguire. Is it Moog or Moog?
Hello.
Hi, Hannah.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Good.
Looking fresh?
I'm really not.
How not fresh are you?
You can probably smell it over the airways. No, I'm kidding. I'm good. I'm just waiting on coffee.
Awesome. I'm waiting on coffee too. While we're waiting on coffee,
let's talk about stuff. I was telling you before
The Mac DeMarco story.
Yeah, you mentioned before the top of the hour that you regretted not going to Mac DeMarco.
Well, I wasn't living in Auckland, so.
Where were you living?
The Bay of Plenty.
Because you're in Wellington for a while, right?
Yeah.
Because I was going to say he played there, but I don't think he played the Bay of Plenty.
Nah.
It's the only concert I've ever walked out on because of how I was really looking forward to it, and it was the first half. It was really good, and then the second half was just pretty bad. Mac was really sweet. In fact, I have a soundbite. Because Mac DeMarco, when I came into the King's Arms, was just like out the front having a cigarette.
Yeah.
So I was like, hey, can I get? Because I know I have my radio show on Monday nights, called Deadhead Radio. And he's a real big Grateful Dead fan, so I used him as a little soundbite.
Awesome.
But I was so high, I had so high hopes, but in the second half, he was lovely, but the guitarist he played with spent about 20 minutes just doing the stupidest set trying to get the band to he kept playing licks of famous songs, and then as soon as the band figured out what he was playing, he just went to do something else.
So it was a bit of an ego.
And he was just yelling stupid stuff. And then they played Enter Sandman. They did a cover of it for about 20 minutes. I walked out during that because I was I'm not dealing with this. Usually I'm not a walkout kind of person. You know when someone says they walk out of a movie, I can't understand how you do that. But Mac was the first time I walked out.
That's a shame. Because I'm sure yeah, I can imagine it would have been a great performance, but then...
Yeah, and someone said his show in Wellington was really good, and the guitarist didn't do that, so maybe the guitarist was just in a bad mood.
Mm. Who knows? So what are we going to be looking at today for A La Moog?
Right, at your request, which, in fairness, you requested a while ago, this is the first in a series of things where we're going to talk about pieces of technology that had an intention and got used for something else.
Cool.
So perhaps the engineer or the company had a different idea. And so we're going to be looking at a classic, because this is the best example for this show, the TB-303, which we've actually looked at. I've looked at with you in the past, but we'll look at it from a different angle.
Cool.
So if you're not familiar, are you familiar with what the TB-303 is?
I feel like yes, but can you re-familiarize my brain?
Okay, I'm going to start off with what... It's made by the company Roland, what they intended it to be and how it ended up slowly progressing, how it ended up being known in the Western pop and electronic music scene. So originally it was designed by a man named Teodawa Kikumoto, who was the head engineer at Roland in 1982. So this guy designed other things like drum machines like the TR-909. And the 808, which are probably the most important, some of the most important bits of music technology in electronic and hip hop. And those are really good, but for the reason that he kind of intended, with the TB-303, not so much. So his idea with the 303, right, because it's a bass synthesizer, was he wanted to create something that would, that could be a satisfying replacement for the electronic bass guitar.
Right.
So, and his intention was to allow musicians who couldn't hire or have a bass player
to use this instead.
More for in composing composing music, or demos,
So you can get an idea of what you would do with the bass, or how you would. Yeah, cool. I get it.
And so the shape of it looks like a little muesli box. No, kind of like a muesli bar sized box. You'd have that, and then you'd have another one that was the same size called a TR-606, which was a drum machine. And so you could program sequences, and you could program with the 606, a drum line, and kind of have them sequenced and play together. So then you could lay down that and a guitar, and then have vocals, you know, or a keyboard, and you can kind of have a good idea of
cool.
a demo. So a few bands did more or less use it for this intention, more in a in their actual music. There's a few songs, one of them which you actually mentioned when you saw what music I had. Like this tune here. So these next three songs I'll show you have the 303 as the bass. This is kind of what Roland intended it to sound like. And we'll listen to one and then we'll talk about it as we go.
Cool.
When I first saw you, something stirred within me. You were standing sultry in the rain. If I could have held you, I would have held you, ripped up and start again. Rip it up and start again. Rip it up and start again.
Cute.
You liked that song, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. I did like that song. It kind of, I don't know, that sound kind of has like a water feel to it. Do you know what I mean? Like there's something kind of like you're under the sea or like, I don't know. I don't know why I thought
that. Well, that's the, it's just kind of because it has this kind of liquidy, resonating filter. Another good example is the song here by a group called Imagination in the Heat of the Moment. This is from 1982. This is more.
Oh, I got an email. Sorry.
Urban Outfitters. this is more of a soul R&B kind of vibe.
God, I love it.
So that's in terms of sounding like a bass guitar, that sounds more like a bass than like Orange Juice.
Yeah.
But
so can you like tune it or kind of change like the tone of it depending on how you like, it's not just one distinct sound, you can kind of change the sound of it.
Yeah,
do you know
so
what
like
I mean?
So like most if not all synthesizers, you're kind of engineering the sound, you're constructing it to sound kind of how you want. And this one, its features were very limited, and its kind of intention was to sound like a bass guitar, but it didn't quite work. The sequencer was a little bit funny, and it was very difficult to program. Here's another one that's supposed to sound like Roland intended. This is a guy called Paul Haig, or a track called Justice.
This is nowhere all right. After justice last night, beyond the law and so high, way past reason, oh my. I get away from it all tonight. I get away from it all tonight.
Delicious 80s.
So it kind of sounds like a bass guitar, but it sounds more... less like a bass guitar, more like a cheesy emulation, a cheesy 80s emulation of a bass guitar,
yeah,
don't
but
you think?
It's nice. I don't know. I like
it.
Yeah, I do. I have a soft spot for it.
Well, it's good. I mean, it does. It's still. It's. Anyway, good to hear. I was gonna make a point there, but then it's disappeared.
You don't like it?
No. I do like it. I think with Orange Juice, with that song "Rip It Up," I find it quite funny. I like it. But I think more because I know what it is and it's like, and its context of it.
It's kind of a humorous sound though, right?
Yeah. That's the thing, you got it, because even when it's been used as supposed to, it still sounds a bit funny.
But it, I don't know, it just kind of works. Yeah.
Well, in terms of its intention, right? Let's compare what an actual bass guitar is like and what a 303 is like. So a bass guitar, right, if you can imagine one, has four strings, has frets, has tuning pegs, you play it with your fingers or a pick, and the timbre, right, which is the sound, the harmonic content, or what the timbre is what distinguishes a bass guitar from a regular guitar or a saxophone, even if it's the same pitch, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The timbre is controlled using selecting which pickups, and you've kind of got a tone control, right? But with the 303, it's, you have to think about it in a very different way. It's controlled by either pressing a note on a very small one octave, kind of these buttons that just make up one octave of notes, or you can sequence it using a sequencer that has different things like slide, which is like sliding from one note to the next, and accent, which is, it's an important thing if you're playing, where you can kind of make notes louder or more distinguished, and that kind of creates a sense of rhythm.
Mm-hmm.
So, and you control the timbre using different oscillators, which make these kind of really rich sounds, and also a filter, which is like an orange juice, that kind of liquidiness when you have the resonance up, and it kind of has this quackiness. So they're quite different to, you can't be a bass player and know how to play bass and then just have the TB-303 and it's really funny reading about it. Roland, when they put it out, so they sent it mostly to the Western markets, so England and the US, and what they for some reason, and I couldn't really get an answer out of this, but they were so confident, either they were so confident that it would be easy to program, or they were so quick to push it out there so they could make money back from the costs of engineering it, that they didn't have an English manual for it. It came with a Japanese manual. So this thing, even knowing how to program it, it's quite complicated to get your head around.
Yeah.
But imagine that, on top of that, just having no way of knowing how to actually work it if you couldn't figure it out. So it was in production for about 18 months, and it was a market failure. And then, thank you, Alice. Got my coffee.
It's going to be hot. You just...
I'm used to cold coffee.
Oh, my God. Did you burn your mouth?
I just burnt my mouth, yeah. anyway.
That was so weird to say.
I was just really thirsty. oh, Jesus.
Got to keep going.
Yeah, okay. And so people bought the TB-303 and had no idea how to use it, and then it ended up in secondhand shops. And then that got picked up by people in, like, Detroit and Chicago who had... no money, and we're using things that were cheap. So it sold originally for $400 in 1982, and in 1987 you could buy it in a secondhand store for $20.
Shit.
So as a result,
it started to get used in a completely different way.
Yeah, and not it. Even though it was called a bass synthesizer, people started to realize what it could be used for in a way that sounded interesting, wasn't just for bass. So here's a really interesting song by a band called 808 State called Flow Coma. This is quite a long sample, so we can talk over it after a while. But
cool.
And there's multiple layers. They kind of layered, either they had many of them going at the same time, or they did multiple layers. So
it's kind of more beaty. I don't know. It's kind of got more of a wave to it, I suppose.
It might just be the way it's... Well, it's kind of got the... In this particular song, he's kind of got... it's kind of a polyrhythm going, so it sounds kind of it's kind of a bit different. But it's not being used to sound like a bass guitar, you know?
No. Oh, no, you wouldn't even think would be.
It kind of has this weird, liquidy, kind of quacky sound that has itself open to... So you can put it through like a distortion pedal, and that sounds really good. That's what a lot of people did, is kind of, once you kind of crunched it up a bit, it has this really distinct sound. But I just realized I don't actually have a... a clip of it, a clip of what that sounds like. But so what people found, right, is once you knew how to sequence it, you kind of thought the language you had to learn to be able to program it lent it to be its own thing. Mm-hmm. You know, it didn't work as something to emulate a bass guitar. It worked as a thing that was its own being. And it took off, you know, like it was this bubbly kind of bizarre sound that was for how limited it was also quite versatile, but also very distinct. You know, once you're familiar with it, you can hear it in song, like you can hear it in pop songs. I think when I talked with you about this last year, that song "Sexy and I," you know that "Sexy and I Know It" song, boom, mm-hmm. boom, 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 mm-hmm. boom, 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 boom. That's a three or three, or like
no way,
or like "Ray of Light" by Madonna has a three or three in it. That's kind of like this, kind of like this pulsing. And you just kind of pick up because it's so distinct, both in its like its sonic content, just how it sounds, and also the sequencer, just how the sequencer worked, made it sound very interesting and bad for its original intention, but good for its own way. And as a result of that, lots of things kind of emerged, lots of different genres. I was listening to a guy talking about electronic music that in the late 80s, early 90s, he said something funny. He was like, the people's experimentation in electronic music was matched only by people's desire to label and genreify all this music. Yeah. So that's why, you know, like from 87 onwards, just every kind of genre of electronic music came out because people always try and label things and put them in boxes. Here's another one by a guy called Plastic Man. This is a little clip of minimalist 303. This is a song called Plasticity.
Awesome.
And here's a short clip of someone using it the same way you would. He kind of used it in the same way an electric guitar, like a solo. So it's not even being used as a bass. It's kind of been higher up in the register. This is by John Frusciante.
Thank you so much, Seamus, for coming in for Alamog.
That's okay. Sweet.
Do you have something else you want to say?
Oh, no, I got a song to finish, but I think you got.
We got Merman.
So you could play it after or just whatever. It's not important.
Yeah, I can play it after.
Sweet.
Cool.
That was A La Morgue. Thanks, Seamus.